The first night engagement had gone to the good guys, and the guardsmen were whooping it up as if after an ACC basketball game.
"I'll know better next time," Ham promised.
"Humility is good for the soul," Marion Diggs said, enjoying the sunrise.
"Death is bad for the body, sir," the colonel reminded him.
"Bah!" Diggs said, grinning on the way to his personal Hummer. Even Al Ham needed the occasional lesson. They took their time. Movistar handled the car rentals. He had duplicate IDs, enough to rent 4 vehicles, 3 four-door private cars, and a U-Haul van. The former had been selected to match vehicles owned by parents who had children at the nursery school. The latter was for their escape, an eventuality which he now thought likely and not merely possible. His men were smarter than he'd appreciated. Driving past the objective in their rented cars, they didn't turn their heads to stare, but allowed their peripheral vision to take in the scene. They already had exact knowledge from the model they'd built, based on data from their leader's photographs. Driving past the site gave them a better full-size three-dimensional view and added more substance to their mental image and to their growing confidence. With that task done, they drove west, turned off Route 50, and proceeded to a lonely farmhouse in southern Anne Arundel County. The house was owned by a man thought by his neighbors to be a Syrian-born Jew who'd lived in the area for 11 years, but who was a sleeper agent. Over the past few years, he'd made discreet purchases of arms and ammunition, all of them legal, and all made before restrictive laws on some of the weapons had been passed. He could have evaded them anyway. In his coat pocket were airline tickets under a different name and passport. This was the final rendezvous point. They would bring the child here. Then 6 of them would leave the country at once, all on separate flights, and the remaining 3 would enter the homeowner's personal car and drive to yet another predetermined location to await developments. America was a vast country with many roads. Cellular telephones were difficult to track. They'd give a devil of a time to their pursuers, Movistar thought. He knew how he'd do things if it got that far. The team with the child would have 1 phone. He would have 2, one to make brief calls to the American government, and another to call his friends. They would demand much for the life of the child, enough to throw this country into chaos. Perhaps the child might even be set free alive. He wasn't sure about that, but he supposed it was possible. Chapter 42. Predator, Prey. CIA has its own Photoshop, of course. The film shot out the aircraft window by Field Officer Domingo Chavez was tagged by the technician in a manner little different from that used by commercial shops, and then processed on standard equipment. There, the routine treatment stopped. The grainy ASA 1200 film produced a poor quality image, and one couldn't give that to the people on the 7th floor. The employees in the Photoshop knew about the RIF order, and the best way to avoid being laid off in this or any other business was to be indispensable. So the developed roll of film went into a computer enhancement system. It took only 3 minutes per frame to convert the images into something that might have been shot by an expert with a Hasselblad under studio conditions. Less than an hour after the film's arrival, the tech produced a set of 8x10 glossies that positively identified the airplane passenger as the Ayatollah Mahmoud Haji Daryai, and provided a shot of his aircraft, so clear and dramatic that the manufacturer might have used it on a sales brochure. The film was put in an envelope and sent off to secure storage. The photos themselves were stored in digital form on tape, their precise identity, date, time of day, location, photographer, and subject, also coded into a computer register for extensive cross-referencing. It was standard procedure. The technician had long since stopped caring about what he developed, though he still did see the occasional frame showing someone on the news in a position that never made the TV screen. But not this guy. From what he'd heard about Daryai, the man probably didn't have much interest in boys or girls.
and the dour expression on his face seemed to confirm it. What the hell, he did have nice taste in airplanes. A G4, it looked like. Odd, wasn't that a Swiss registration code on the tail, though? When the photos went upstairs, one complete set was also set aside for a different kind of analysis. A physician would examine them closely. Some diseases left visible signs, and the agency always kept an eye on the health of foreign leaders. "Secretary Adler will be leaving for Beijing this morning," Ryan told them. Arnie had told him that, as unpleasant as these news appearances were, being seen on TV doing presidential things was good for him politically. And that, Arnie always went on, meant being more effective in the job. The president also remembered hearing from his mom how important it was to go to the dentist twice a year, too. And just as the antiseptic smells of that place were certain to frighten a child, so he had come to loathe the damp of this room. The walls leaked, some of the windows were cracked, and this part of the west wing of the White House was about as neat and well-kept as a high school locker room, something the citizens couldn't tell from watching TV. Though the area was only a few yards from his own office, nobody really cared much about tidying things up. Reporters were such slobs, the staff claimed, that it wouldn't have mattered much anyway. What the hell, the reporters didn't seem to worry about it. "Mr. President, have we learned anything more about the airliner incident?" "It's been announced that the body count is complete. The flight data recorders have been recovered, and will we have access to the black box information?" Why did they call it the black box when it was orange? Jack had always wondered about that, but knew he'd never get a sensible answer. "We've asked for that access, and the Republic of China government has promised its full cooperation." "They don't have to do that. The aircraft is registered in that country, and the aircraft is made in Europe. But they are being helpful. We acknowledge that with thanks. I should add that none of the Americans who survived the crash itself are in any medical danger. Some of the injuries are severe, but not life-threatening." "Who shot it down?" another reporter asked. "We're still examining the data, and..." "Mr. President, the Navy has two Aegis-class ships in that immediate area. You must have a good idea of what happened." This guy had done his homework. "I really can't comment further on that. Secretary Adler will discuss the incident with the parties concerned. We want, first of all, to make sure that no further loss of life takes place." "Mr. President, a follow-up. You must know more than you're saying. 14 Americans were killed in this incident. The American people have a right to know why." The hell of it was, the man was right. The hell of it also was that Ryan had to evade. "We really do not know exactly what happened yet. I cannot make a definitive statement until we do." Which was philosophically true, anyway. He knew who'd taken the shot. He didn't know why. Adler had made a good point yesterday on keeping that knowledge close. "Mr. Adler returned from somewhere yesterday. Why is that a secret?" It was Plummer again, chasing down his question from the previous day. "I'm going to kill Arnie for exposing me this way all the time." "John, the secretary, was engaged in some important consultations. That's all I have to say on the issue." "He was in the Middle East, wasn't he?" Next question. "Sir, the Pentagon has announced that the carrier Eisenhower is moving into the South China Sea. Did you order that?" "Yes, I did. We feel that the situation warrants our close attention. We have vital interests in that region. I point out that we are not taking sides in this dispute, but we are going to look after our own interests." "Will moving the carrier cool things down or heat them up?" "Obviously, we're not trying to make things worse. We're trying to make them better. It's in the interests of both parties to take a step back and think about what they are doing." "Lives have been lost," the president reminded them. "Some of those were American lives. That gives us a direct interest in the matter. The reason we have a government and a military is to look after American interests and to protect the lives of our citizens. The naval forces heading for the region will observe what is happening and conduct routine training operations. That is all." Zhang Hansan checked his watch again and remarked to himself that it was becoming a fine way to end his working day. the sight of the American president doing exactly what he wanted him to do. Now China had fulfilled her obligations to that Darii barbarian. The Indian Ocean was devoid of a major American naval presence for the first time in 20 years. The American foreign minister would leave Washington in another 2 hours or so. Another 18 hours to fly to Beijing, and then the platitudes could be exchanged. He'd see what concessions he could wring out of America and the Taiwanese puppet state. Maybe a few good ones, he thought, with the trouble America was sure to face elsewhere. Adler was in his office. His bags were packed and in his official car, which would take him to the White House to catch a helicopter to Andrews after a presidential handshake and a brief departure statement, which would be as bland as oatmeal. The more dramatic departure would look good on TV, make his mission appear to be a matter of importance, and cause additional wrinkling to his clothes. But the Air Force crew had an ironing board on the plane. "What do we know?" Undersecretary Rutledge asked of the secretary's senior staff. "The missile was shot by a PRC aircraft. That's pretty positive from the Navy's radar tapes. No idea why, though Admiral Jackson is very positive in saying that it was not an accident." "How was it in Tehran?" another assistant secretary inquired. "Equivocal. I'll get that written up on the flight and fax it back here." Adler, too, was pressed for time and hadn't had enough to think through his meeting with Darii. "We need that if we're going to be much use on the Snai," Rutledge pointed out. He really wanted that document. With it, Ed Keelty could prove that Ryan was up to his old tricks, playing secret agent man, and even suborning Scott Adler into doing the same. It was out there somewhere, the key to destroying Ryan's political legitimacy. He was dodging and counterpunching well, doubtless due to Arnie Van Damme's coaching. But his gaffe yesterday on China policy had sent rumbles throughout the building. Like many people at state, he wished that Taiwan would just go away and enable America to get on with the business of conducting normal relations with the world's newest superpower. "One thing at a time, Cliff." The meeting returned to the China issue. By mutual consent, it was decided that the UIR problem was on the back burner for the next few days. "Any change in China policy from the White House?" Rutledge asked. Adler shook his head. "No, the president was just trying to talk his way through things. And yeah, I know he shouldn't have called the Republic of China China, but maybe it rattled their cage just a little in Beijing. And I'm not all that displeased about it. They do need to learn about not killing Americans. We have crossed a line here, people. One of the things I have to do is let them know that we take that line seriously." "Accidents happen," someone observed. "The Navy says it wasn't an accident." "Come on, Mr. Secretary," Rutledge groaned. "Why the hell would they do that on purpose?" "It's our job to find out. Admiral Jackson made a good case for his position. If you're a cop on the street and you have an armed robber in front of you, why shoot the little old lady down the block?" "Accident, obviously," Rutledge persisted. "Cliff, there are accidents and there are accidents. This one killed Americans. And in case anybody in this room forgot, we are supposed to take that seriously." They weren't used to that sort of reprimand. What was with Adler, anyway? The job of the State Department was to maintain the peace, to forestall conflict that killed people in the thousands. Accidents were accidents. They were unfortunate, but they happened, like cancer and heart attacks. State was supposed to deal with the big picture. "Thank you, Mr. President." Ryan left the podium, having again survived the slings and arrows of the media. He checked his watch. Damn, he'd missed seeing the kids off to school, again, and hadn't kissed Kathy goodbye either. Where in the Constitution, he wondered, was it written down that the President wasn't a human being? On reaching his office, he scanned the printed sheet of his daily schedule. Adler was due over in an hour for the send-off to China. Winston at 10 o'clock to go over the details of his administrative changes across the street at Treasury. Arnie and Callie at 11 to go through his speeches for next week. Lunch with Tony Brattano. A meeting after lunch with... who? The Anaheim Mighty Ducks? Ryan shook his head. Oh, they'd won the Stanley Cup, and this would be a photo opportunity for them and for him. He had to talk to Arnie about that political crap. Ought to have Ed Foley over for that, Jack smiled to himself. He was a hockey fanatic. You're running late, Don Russell said, as Pat O'Day dropped Megan off. The FBI inspector continued past him, saw to Megan's coat and blankie, then returned. The power went off last night and reset my clock radio for me, he explained. Big day planned? Pat shook his head. Desk day. I have to finish up a few things. You know the drill. Both did. It was essentially editing and indexing reports, a secretarial function which, on sensitive cases, was often done by sworn gun-toting agents. I hear you want to have a little contest, Russell said. They say you're pretty good. Oh, fair, I guess, the Secret Service agent allowed. Yeah, I try to keep the shots inside the lines, too. Like the Sig's Hour? The FBI agent shook his head. Smith 1076 stainless. The 10mm. It makes a bigger hole, O'Day pointed out. 9's always been enough for me, Russell reported. Then both men laughed. You hustle pool, too? The FBI agent asked. Not since high school, Pat. Shall we set the amount of the wager? It has to be serious, O'Day thought. Case of Samuel Adams, Russell suggested. An honorable bet, sir, the inspector agreed. How about at Beltsville? That was the site of the Secret Service Academy. The outside range. Indoors is always too artificial. Standard combat match? I haven't shot bullseyes in years. I don't ever expect one of my principals to be attacked by a black dot. Tomorrow? It seemed a good Saturday diversion. That's probably a little quick. I can check. I'll know this afternoon. Don, you have a deal. And may the best man win. They both shook hands. The best man will, Pat. He always does. Both men knew who it would be, though one of them would have to be wrong. Both also knew that the other would be a good guy to have at your back, and that the beer would taste pretty good either way when the issue was decided. The weapons weren't fully automatic. A good machinist could have changed that, but the sleeper agent wasn't one of those. Movie Star and his people didn't mind all that much. They were trained marksmen and knew that full auto was only good for 3 rounds unless you had the arms of a gorilla. After that, the gun jumped up and you were just drilling holes in the sky instead of the target, who just might fire back at you. There was neither time nor space for another round of shooting, but they were familiar with the weapon type, the Chinese knockoff of the Soviet AK-47, itself a development of a German weapon from the 1940s. It fired a short case 7.62mm cartridge. The magazines held 30 rounds each. The team members used duct tape to double them up, inserting and ejecting the magazines to be sure that everything fit properly. With that task completed, they resumed their examination of the objective. Each of them knew his place and his task. Each also knew the dangers involved, but they didn't dwell on that. Nor, Movie Star saw, did they dwell on the nature of the mission. They were so dehumanized by their years of activity within the terrorist community that, though this was the first real mission for most of them, all they really thought about was proving themselves. How they did it exactly was less important. They're going to bring up a lot of things, Adler said. Think so? Jack asked. You bet. Most favored nation, copyright disputes, you name it. It'll all come up. The president grimaced. It seemed obscene to place the copyright protection for Barbra Streisand CDs alongside the deliberate killing of so many people, but... Yeah, Jack, they just don't think about stuff the same way we do. Reading my mind? I'm a diplomat, remember? You think I just listen to what people say out loud? Hell, we'd never get any negotiations done that way. It's like playing a long, low-stakes card game, boring and tense all at the same time.
I've been thinking about the lives lost. I have too, Sextate replied with a nod.
You can't dwell on it. It's a sign of weakness in their context.
But I won't forget it either.
That got a rise out of his commander-in-chief.
Why is it, Scott, that we always have to respect their cultural context? Why is it that they never seem to respect ours? POTUS wanted to know.
It's always been that way at State.
That doesn't answer the question, Jack pointed out.
If we lean too hard on that, Mr. President, it's like being a hostage. Then the other side always knows that they can hang a couple of lives over us and use it to pressure us. It gives them an advantage.
Only if we allow it. The Chinese need us as much as we need them. More with the trade surplus. Taking lives is playing rough. We can play rough, too. I've always wondered why we don't.
Sextate adjusted his glasses.
Sir, I do not disagree with that, but it has to be thought through very carefully, and we do not have the time to do that now. You're talking a doctrinal change in American policy. You don't shoot from the hip on something that big.
When you get back, let's get together over a weekend with a few others and see if there are any options. I don't like what we've been doing on this issue in a moral sense, and I don't like it because it makes us a little too predictable.
How so?
Playing by a given set of rules is all well and good, as long as everybody plays by the same rules. But playing by a known set of rules when the other guy doesn't just makes us an easy mark, Ryan speculated.
On the other hand, if somebody else breaks the rules and then we break them too, maybe in a different way, but break them even so, it gives him something to think about.
You want to be predictable to your friends, yes, but what your enemy needs to predict is that messing with you gets him hurt. How hurt he gets, that part we make unpredictable.
Not without merit, Mr. President. Sounds like a nice subject for a weekend up at Camp David.
Both men stopped talking when the helicopter came down on the pad.
There's my driver. Got your statement?
Yeah, and about as dramatic as a weather report on a sunny day.
That's how the game is played, Jack, Adler pointed out.
He reflected that Ryan was hearing a lot of that song. No wonder he was bridling at it.
I've never run across a game where they never changed the rules. Baseball went to a designated hitter to liven things up, POTUS remarked casually.
Designated hitter, Sextate wondered on his way out the door.
Great choice of words.
15 minutes later, Ryan watched the helicopter lift off. He'd done the handshake for the cameras, made his brief statement for the cameras, looked serious but upbeat for the cameras. Maybe C-SPAN had covered it live, but nobody else would. Were it to be a slow news day, Friday in Washington often was, it might get a minute and a half on one or two of the evening news shows. More likely not. Friday was their day to summarize the week's events, recognize some person or other for doing something or other, and toss in a fluff story.
Mr. President!
Jack turned to see Trader, his Secretary of the Treasury, walking over a few minutes early.
Hi, George.
That tunnel between here and my building?
What about it?
I took a look at it this morning. It's a real mess. You have any beefs about cleaning it up? Winston asked.
George, that's a Secret Service function, and you own them, remember?
Yeah, I know, but it does come to your house, and so I thought I ought to ask.
Okay, I'll get it taken care of. Might be nice for when it rains.
How's the tax plan coming? Ryan asked, on his way to the door.
An agent yanked it open and held it for him. Such things still made Jack uncomfortable. A man had to do some things for himself.
We'll have the computer models done next week. I really want the case tight on this one. Revenue neutral, easier on the little guy, fair on the big guy. And I have my people jumping through hoops on the administrative savings.
Jesus, Jack, was I wrong about that?
What do you mean?
They turned the corner for the Oval Office.
I thought I was the only guy pissing money away to work the tax code. Everybody does. It's a huge industry. It'll put a lot of people out of work.
I'm supposed to be happy about that?
They'll all find honest work, except for the lawyers, maybe. And we'll save the taxpayers a few billion dollars by giving them a tax form they can figure out from fourth-grade math. Mr. President, the government doesn't insist that people buy buggy whips, does it?
Ryan told his secretary to call Arnie in. He'd want a little political guidance on the ramifications of Georgia's plan.
Yes, Admiral?
You asked for a report on the Eisenhower Group, Jackson said, walking to the large wall map and consulting a slip of paper. They're right here, making good speed. Then Robbie's pager started vibrating in his pocket. He pulled it out and checked the number. His eyebrows went up.
Sir, do you mind?
Go ahead, Secretary Bertano said.
Jackson took the phone on the other side of the room, dialing five digits.
J3 here.
Oh?
Where are they?
Then let's find out, shall we, Commander?
Correct.
He put the phone back.
That was the NMCC. The NRO reports that the Indian Navy's missing. Their two carriers, that is.
What does that mean, Admiral?
Robbie walked back to the map and walked his hand across the blue part west of the Indian subcontinent.
36 hours since the last time we checked. Figure 3 hours to clear the port and form up. 20 knots times 33 is 660 nautical miles. That's 760 statute miles, about halfway between their home port and the Horn of Africa.
He turned. Mr. Secretary, they have two carriers, 9 escorts, and an unrep group missing from their piers. The fleet oilers mean they might be planning to stay out for a while. We had no intelligence information to warn us about this.
As usual, he didn't add.
So where exactly are they?
That's the point. We don't know. We have some P-3 Orion aircraft based at Diego Garcia. They're going to launch a couple to go looking. We can task some satellite assets to the job also. We need to tell State about this. Maybe the embassy can find out something.
Fair enough. I'll tell the President in a few minutes. Anything to worry about?
Could be they're just putting out after completing repairs.
We rattled their cage pretty hard a while back, as you know. But now the only two aircraft carriers in the Indian Ocean are somebody else's?
Yes, sir.
And our nearest one is heading the wrong way.
But at least SecDef was catching on some. Adler was in a former Air Force One, an old but solid version of the venerable 707-320B. His official party comprised 8 people, with 5 Air Force stewards to look after them. For the moment, he looked at his watch, computed the travel time. They had to stop for fuel at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska, and decided he'd catch up on his sleep during the last leg. What a shame, he thought, that the government didn't award frequent flyer miles. He'd be traveling free for the rest of his life. For now, he took out his Tehran notes and started examining them again. He closed his eyes, trying to recall additional details as he relived the experience from his arrival at Mehrabad to the departure, visualizing every single episode. Every few minutes, he opened his eyes, flipped to the page in his notes, and made a few marginal comments. With luck, he'd be able to have them typed up and sent by secure fax to Washington for the SNI team.
"Ding, maybe you have another career ahead of you," Mary Pat observed, as she examined the photo through a magnifying glass. Her voice went on in some disappointment. "He looks healthy."
"You suppose being a son of a bitch is good for longevity?" Clark asked.
"Worked for you, Mr. C," Chavez joked. "I may have to put up with this for the next 30 years. But such handsome grandsons you will have, Jefe, and bilingual."
"Back to business, shall we?" Mrs. Foley suggested. "Friday afternoon or not."
It's never fun to be ill on an airplane. He wondered what he'd eaten,
Or maybe he'd picked up something in San Francisco at the computer show. All those damned people around. The executive was an experienced traveler, and his personal first aid kit never left his side. In with his razor and such, he found some Tylenol. He washed two down with a glass of wine and decided that he'd just try to sleep it off. With luck, he'd feel better by the time his flight made it into Newark. Sure as hell he didn't want to drive home feeling like this. He eased the seat all the way back, clicked off the light, and closed his eyes. It was time. The rental cars pulled away from the farmhouse. Each driver knew the route to and from the objective. There were no maps or other written material in their vehicles aside from photos of their prey. If any of them had uneasy feelings about kidnapping a small child, none showed it. Instead, their weapons were loaded and set on safe, and in every case sat on the floor, covered with a blanket or cloth. All wore suits and ties, so that if a police car pulled alongside, a look would reveal only three well-groomed men, probably businessmen in nice private cars. The team thought that last part amusing. The movie star was a stickler for proper appearance, probably, they all thought, because of his vanity. Price watched the arrival of the Mighty Ducks with no small amusement. She'd seen it all before. The most powerful of men walked into this place and were turned into children by it. What to her and her colleagues was just part of the scenery, the paintings and so forth, was to others the trappings of ultimate power. And in a way, she admitted to herself, they were right and she was wrong. Anything can become routine after sufficient repetition, whereas the new visitor, seeing everything for the first time, may have seen more clearly. The processing helped make it that way, as they came through the metal detectors under the watchful eyes of members of the USSS Uniformed Division. They'd get a quick walk-around while the president finished his meeting with the SecDef, which was reportedly running very late. The hockey players, bearing gifts for the president, the usual sticks, pucks, and a jersey sweater with his name on it, actually they had them for the whole family, shuffled through the passage from the east entrance, their eyes sweeping left and right over the decorations on the white-painted walls of what, for Andrea, was a place of work, and for them something else, powerful and special. An interesting dualism, she thought, walking over to Jeff Raymond. I'm heading over to check out arrangements for Sandbox. I heard Don was getting a little antsy. Anything I need to know? She shook her head. POTUS isn't planning anything special. Callie Weston will be over later. They changed her slot. Otherwise, everything's routine. Fair enough, Raymond acknowledged. This is Price, she said into her microphone. Show me in transit to Sandbox. Roger that, the command post replied. The detail chief headed out the way the Mighty Ducks had come in, and turned left for her personal vehicle, a Ford Crown Victoria. The vehicle looked ordinary, but wasn't. Under the hood was the biggest standard engine Ford made. There were two cellular phones and a pair of secure radios. The tires had steel discs inside, so that were one to be flattened, the car could still drive. Like all members of the detail, she'd been trained in the service's special evasive driving course at Beltsville. It was something they all loved. And in her purse was her 6-hour 9mm automatic, along with two spare clips, plus her lipstick and credit cards. Price was a fairly ordinary-looking woman. Not as pretty as Helen D'Agostino. She sighed at the memory. Andrea and Daga had been close. The latter had helped her through a divorce and gotten her some dates. Good friend, good agent. Dead with all the rest that night on the hill. Daga, nobody in the service had called her Helen, had been blessed with Mediterranean features that stopped just short of voluptuous, and that had made for a fine disguise. She just hadn't looked at all like a cop. Presidential aide, secretary, or mistress, maybe. But Andrea was more ordinary, and so she donned the sunglasses that agents on the detail adopted. She was no nonsense, maybe a little strident,
They'd said that about her once, back when it had been a novelty for women to join up and carry guns. The system was over that now. Now she was one of the boys, to the point that she laughed at the jokes and told some of her own. Her instant assumption of command on that night with Swordsman, getting his family to safety, she owed Ryan and Rhiannu. He'd made the call because he liked the way she did things. She would never have made detail chief so rapidly but for his instant decision. Yes, she had the savvy. Yes, she knew the personnel very well. Yes, she genuinely loved the work. But she was young for the responsibility, and female. POTUS didn't seem to care, however. He hadn't picked her because she was female, and it might therefore look good to the voting public. He'd done it because she'd gotten the job done during a tough time. That made it right, and that made Swordsman special. He even asked her questions about things. That was unique. She didn't have a husband. She didn't have kids, probably never would. Andrea Price wasn't one of those who sought to escape her womanhood in pursuit of a career. She wanted it all, but she hadn't quite managed that. Her career was important. She could think of nothing more vital to her country than what she did. And the good news was that it was so all-encompassing that she rarely had the time to dwell on what was missing. A good man to share her bed, and a small voice to call her Mommy. But on drives alone she did think about it, like now, heading up New York Avenue. "Not all that liberated at all, are we?" she asked the windshield. But the service didn't pay her to be liberated. It paid her to look after the first family. Her personal life was supposed to run on her personal time, though the service didn't issue her any of that either. Inspector O'Day was already on Route 50. Friday was best of all. He'd done his duty for the week. His tie and suit jacket were on the seat next to him, and he was back in his leather bomber jacket and his lucky John Deere ball cap, without which he'd never consider playing golf or going out to hunt. This weekend he had a ton of things to do around the house. Megan would help with many of them. Somehow she knew. Pat didn't fully understand it. Maybe it was instinct. Maybe she just responded to her father's devotion. However it came about, the two were inseparable. At home she left his side only to sleep, and only then after a major hug and kiss, her little arms tight around his neck. O'Day chuckled to himself. Tough guy. Russell supposed it was the grandfather in him. All these little munchkins. They were playing outside now, every one in his or her parka, about half with the hoods up, because little kids liked that for some reason. Serious playtime here. Sandbox was in the sandbox, along with the O'Day kid who so closely resembled her, and a little boy, the Walker kid, the rather nice young son of that pain-in-the-ass with the Volvo wagon. Agent Hilton was out, too, supervising. Strangely, they could relax more out here. The playground was on the north side of the Giant Steps building, under the direct view of the support team just across the street. The third member of the team was inside on the phone. She ordinarily worked the back room, where the TV monitors were. The kids knew her as Miss Anne. Too thin, Russell told himself, even as he watched the toddlers having the purest sort of fun. In the extreme case, somebody could drive by on Ritchie Highway and hose the place. Trying to talk the Ryans out of sending Kathy here was a wasted effort, and sure, they wanted their youngest to be a normal kid, but it was all insane, wasn't it? Russell's entire professional life had revolved around the knowledge that there were people who hated the president and everyone around him. Some were truly crazy. Some were something else. He'd studied the psychology of it. He had to, since learning about them helped to predict what to look for. But that wasn't the same as understanding it. These were kids. Even the fucking mafia, he knew, didn't mess with children. He sometimes envied the FBI for its statutory authority to track down kidnappers. To rescue a child and apprehend the criminal in that sort of case must be a sweet moment indeed. though part of him wondered how hard it was to bring in alive that kind of subject, instead of just sending him off to have his Miranda rights read to him by God himself. That random thought evoked a smile. Or maybe what really happened was better yet. Kidnappers had a very bad time in prison. Even hardened robbers couldn't stomach the abusers of children, and so that variety of hood learned a whole new form of recreation in the federal correction system. Survival.
"Russell, command post," his earpiece said.
"Russell." "Price is heading out here like you requested," Special Agent Norm Jeffers said from the house across the street.
40 minutes, she says.
"Right. Thanks."
"I see the Walker lad is continuing his engineering studies," the voice continued.
"Yeah, maybe he'll do bridges next," Don agreed.
The youngster had the second-level building on his sandcastle, to the rapt admiration of Katie Ryan and Megan O'Day.
"Mr. President," the team captain said, "I hope you'll like this."
Ryan had a good laugh and donned the team jersey for the cameras. The team bunched around him for the shot.
"My CIA director is a big hockey fan," Jack said.
"Really?"
Bob Albertson asked.
He was a very physical defenseman, the terror of his conference for his board checking, but as docile as a kitten in this setting.
"Yeah, he has a kid who's pretty good, played in the kids' leagues in Russia."
"And then maybe he learned something. Where's he go to school?"
"I'm not sure what colleges they're thinking about. I think they said Eddie wants to study engineering."
It was so damned pleasant, Jack thought, to talk about normal things like a normal person to other normal people once in a while.
"Tell them to send the kid to Rensselaer. It's a good tech school up by Albany."
"Why there?"
"Those damn nerds win the college championship every other year. I went to Minnesota, and they cleaned our clock twice in a row. Send me his name, and I'll see he gets some stuff. His dad, too, if that's okay, Mr. President."
"I'll do that," the president promised.
6 feet away, Agent Raymond heard the exchange and nodded.
O'Day arrived just as the kids were trooping back in the side door for bathroom call. This, he knew, was a major undertaking. He pulled his diesel pickup in just after 4. He watched the Secret Service agents switch positions. Russell appeared at the front door, his regular post for when the children were inside.
"We got us a match for tomorrow?"
Russell shook his head.
"Too quick. 2 weeks from tomorrow, 2 in the afternoon. It'll give you a chance to practice."
"And you won't?" O'Day asked, passing inside.
He watched Megan enter the girls' bathroom without seeing her daddy in the room.
"Well, then." He squatted down outside the door to surprise her when she came out.
Movie Star 2 was at his surveillance position in the school parking lot to the northeast. The trees were starting to fill in, he realized. He could see, but his view was somewhat obstructed. Things appeared normal even so, and from this point on it was in Allah's hands, he told himself, surprised that he used the term for a decidedly ungodly act. As he watched, Car 1 turned right just north of the daycare center. It would proceed down the street, reverse directions, and head back. Car 2 was a white Lincoln town car, the twin of one belonging to a family with a child here. That family comprised 2 physicians, though none of the terrorists knew that. Immediately behind it was a red Chrysler, whose twin belonged to the again-pregnant wife of an accountant. As Movie Star watched, both pulled into parking spaces opposite each other, as close to the highway as the parking lot allowed.
Price would be here soon. Russell took note of the car's arrival, thinking over his arguments for the detail chief. The afternoon sun reflected off the windshields, preventing him from seeing anything more inside than the outline of the drivers. Both cars were early, but it was a Friday. The tag numbers? His eyes narrowed slightly as he shook his head, asking himself why he hadn't. Someone else had. Jeffers lifted his binoculars, scanning the arriving cars as part of his surveillance duties. He didn't even know he had a photographic memory. Remembering things was as natural to him as breathing. He thought everyone could do it.
Wait, something's wrong here. They're not—"
He lifted the radio mic.
"Russell, those are not our cars."
It was almost in time. In one smooth motion, two drivers opened their car doors and swung their legs out, lifting their weapons off the front seats as they did so. In the back of both cars, two pairs of men came up, also armed. Russell's right hand moved back and down, reaching for his automatic, while his left lifted the collar-mounted radio microphone. Gun! Inside the building, Inspector O'Day heard something but wasn't sure what, and he was facing the wrong way to see how Agent Marcella Hilton turned away from a child who was asking her a question and shoved her hand into her gun purse. It was the simplest of code words. An instant later, he heard the same word repeated over his earpiece as Norm Jeffers shouted it from the command post. The black agent's hand pushed another button, activating a radio link to Washington. Sandstorm! 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 Like most career cops, Special Agent Don Russell had never fired his sidearm in anger, but years of training made his every action as automatic as gravity. The first thing he'd seen was the elevated front sight of an AK-47 class automatic rifle. With that, as though a switch had been thrown, he changed from a watchful cop into a guidance system for a firearm. His 6 hour was out now. His left hand was racing to meet his right on the grip of the weapon, as the rest of his body dropped to one knee to lower his profile and give him better control. The man with the rifle would get the first shot off, but it would miss high, Russell's mind reported. Three such rounds did, passing over his head into the doorframe as the area exploded with staccato noise. While that was happening, his tritium-coated front sight matched up with the face behind the weapon. Russell depressed the trigger, and from 15 yards he fired a round straight into the shooter's left eye. Inside, O'Day's own instincts were just lighting off when Megan emerged from the bathroom, struggling with the suspender clips on her Oshkosh coveralls. Just then, the agent the kids knew as Miss Anne bolted out of the back room, her pistol in both hands, and pointed up. "Jesus," the FBI inspector had time to say, when Miss Anne bounded right through him like an NFL fullback, knocking him down at his daughter's feet and banging his head against the wall in the process. Across the street, two agents ran out the front door of the residence, both holding Uzi submachine guns, while Jeffers worked the communications inside. He'd already gotten the emergency code word to headquarters. Next, he activated the direct drop lines to Barracks J of the Maryland State Police on Roe Boulevard in Annapolis. There was noise and confusion, but the agents were expertly drilled. Jeffers' function was to make sure that the word got out, then to back up the other two members of his team already crossing the lawn of the house. They never had a chance. From 50 yards away, the shooters from Car 1 dropped both of them with aimed fire. Jeffers watched them go down while he got the word to the state police. He didn't have time for shock. As soon as his information was acknowledged, he lifted his M16 rifle, flipped off the safety, and moved for the door. Russell shifted fire. Another shooter made the mistake of standing to get a better shot. He never made it. Two quick rounds exploded his head like a melon, saw the agent, who was not thinking, not feeling, not doing anything but servicing targets as quickly as he could identify them. The enemy rounds were still going over his head. Then he heard a scream. His mind reported that it was Marcella Hilton, and he felt something heavy fall on his back and knock him to the ground. Dear God, it had to be Marcella. Her body, something, was on his legs, and as he rolled to get clear of the obstruction, four men came into view, advancing toward him, now with a clear line of sight to where he was. He fired one round that scored, drilling one of them right through the heart. The man's eyes went wide with the shock of the impact, until a second round took him in the face. It was like he'd always dreamed it would be. The gun was doing all the work. His peripheral vision showed movement to his left, the support group. But no, it was a car, driving across the playground right at them. Not the Suburban, something else. He scarcely could tell as his pistol centered on another shooter, but that man went down, shot three times by Ann Pemberton in the doorway behind him. The remaining two, only two, he had a chance. Then Annie got one in the chest, then fell forward, and Russell knew he was alone, all alone now, only him between Sandbox and these motherfuckers. Don Russell rolled to his right to avoid fire on the ground to his left, shooting as his body turned, getting off two rounds that went wild. Then his SIG locked open on an empty magazine. He had another ready, and instantly he ejected the empty and slapped in a full one. But that took time,
and he felt a round enter his lower back, the impact like a kick that shook his body. As his right thumb dropped the slide lever, and another bullet struck him in the left shoulder, ripping all the way down his torso to exit out his right leg. One more round, but he couldn't get the gun high enough, something wasn't working right, and he hit somebody straight through the kneecap an instant before a series of shots lowered his face to the ground. O'Day was just trying to get up when two men came through the door, both armed with AKs. He looked around the room, now full of stunned, silent kids. The silence seemed to hang for a long moment, then turned to the shrill screams of toddlers. One of the men had blood all over his leg, and was gritting his teeth in pain and rage. Outside, the three men from Car 1 surveyed the carnage. Four men were dead, they saw, as they jumped out of the car, but they'd done for the covering group, and the first one out the right rear door fell face down. The other two turned around to see a black man in a white shirt with a gray rifle. Eat shit and die. His memory would fail him on this occasion. Norman Jeffers would never remember saying that as he shifted to the next target and squeezed off a three-round burst into his head. The third man of the team, which had killed his two friends, dropped behind the front of his car. But the car was stuck in the middle of the playground with open air to the left and right.
"Come on, stick it up and say hi, Charlie," the agent breathed.
And sure enough he did, swinging his weapon around to shoot back at the remaining bodyguard, but not fast enough. His eyes as open and unblinking as an owl's, Jeffers watched the blood cloud fly back as the target disappeared. "Norm!" It was Paula Michaels, the afternoon surveillance agent from the 7-Eleven across the street, her pistol out and in both hands. Jeffers dropped to one knee behind the car whose occupants he'd just killed. She joined him, and with the sudden negation of activity, both agents started breathing heavily, their hearts racing, their heads pounding. "Get a count?" she asked. "At least one made it inside." "Two. I saw two. One hit in the leg." "Oh, Jesus. Don, Ann, Marcella." "Save it. We got kids in there, Paula. Fuck!" So, movie star thought, it wasn't going to work out after all. "Damn it," he swore silently. He'd told them there were three people in the house to the north. Why hadn't they waited to kill the third? They could have had the child away from here by now. Well, he shook his head clear. He'd never fully expected the mission to succeed. He'd warned Bedrine of that, and picked his people accordingly. Now all he had to do was watch to make sure. What, would they kill the child? That was something they'd discussed. But they might not fulfill their duty before they died. Price had been 5 miles out when the emergency call had come over her radio. In less than 2 seconds, she had the pedal to the floor and the car accelerating through traffic, the flashing light in place and siren screaming. Turning north onto Ritchie Highway, she could see cars blocking the road. Immediately, she maneuvered left onto the median, the car sideslipping as it clawed its way across the inward-sloping surface. She arrived a few seconds ahead of the first olive and black Maryland State Police radio car. "Price, is that you?" "Say who," she replied. "Norm Jeffers. I think we have two subjects inside. We have 5 agents down. Michaels is with me now. I'm sending her around the back." "There in a second." "Watch your ass, Andrea," Jeffers warned. O'Day shook his head. His ears were still ringing and his head sore from the hit on the wall. His daughter was next to him, shielded by his body from the two terrorists, who were now sweeping their weapons left and right around the room while the kids screamed. Mrs. Daggett moved slowly, standing between them and her kids, instinctively holding her hands in the open. Around them all the kids were cowering. There were cries for Mommy. None for Daddy, oddly enough, O'Day realized. And a lot of wet pants. "Mr. President," Raymond said, pressing his earpiece in tight. "What the hell was this?" At St. Mary's, the call of sandstorm over the radio links had hit the shadow shortstop details with a thunderbolt. Agents standing outside the classrooms of the Ryan kids slammed in, weapons drawn, to drag their protectees out to the corridor. Questions were asked, but none answered, as the detail fell into the preset plan for such an event. Both kids entered the same Chevy Suburban, which drove not out to the road, but off to a service building across the athletic field. One way in, one way out of this place,
and an ambush team might be right out there, disguised as Christ knew what. In Washington, a Marine helicopter spooled up to fly to the school and extract the Ryan children. The second Suburban took position on the field, 150 yards from where the kids were. The class that had been doing gym outside was chased off, and agents stood behind their Kevlar-armored vehicle, heavy weapons out, looking for targets.
"Doc!"
Kathy Ryan looked up from her desk. Roy had never called her that before. He'd never had his pistol out in her presence either, knowing that she was not fond of firearms. Her reaction was probably instinctive. Kathy's face went as white as her lab coat.
"Is it Jack or—"
"It's Katie. That's all I know, Doc. Please come with me right now."
"No, not again, not again."
Altman wrapped his arm around Surgeon to guide her out into the corridor. Four more agents were there, weapons out and faces grim. Hospital security people kept out of the way, though uniformed Baltimore City police made up an outer perimeter, all of them trying to remember to look outward toward a possible threat, not inward toward a mother whose child was in peril. Ryan stretched out his arm, placed his hand against the wall of his office, looked down, and bit his lip for a second before speaking.
"Tell me what you know, Jeff."
"Two subjects are in the building. Don Russell is dead. So are four other agents, sir. But we have it contained, okay? Let us do the work," Agent Raymond said, touching the extended arm to steady the president.
"Why my kids, Jeff? I'm the one here. If people get mad, it's supposed to be at me. Why do people like this go after children? Tell me that."
"It's a hateful act, Mr. President. Hateful to God and man," Raymond said, as three more agents came into the Oval Office. What was he doing now, the assassin asked himself. What in hell was he doing? Why had he said that? They were talking in a language he didn't understand. O'Day stayed down, sitting on the floor with his little girl, holding her in his lap with both arms and trying to look as harmless as she did. Dear God, all the years he'd trained for things like this. But never to be inside, never to be in the crime scene while the crime happened. Outside, you knew what to do. He knew exactly what was happening. If any service people were left—probably some, yes, there had to be. Somebody had fired three or four bursts with an M-16. O'Day knew the distinctive chatter of that weapon. No more bad guys had entered. His mind added those facts up. Okay, there were good guys outside. First, they'd establish a perimeter to make sure nobody got in or out. Next, they'd call in... who? The service probably had its own SWAT team, but also, close by, would be the FBI hostage rescue team, with its own choppers to get them here. Almost on cue, he heard a helicopter overhead.
"This is Trooper 3. We're orbiting the area now," a voice said over the radio. "Who's in charge down there?"
"This is Special Agent Price, United States Secret Service. How long you with us, Trooper?" she asked over a state police radio.
"We have gas for 90 minutes, and then another chopper will relieve us."
"Looking down now, Agent Price," the pilot reported.
"I have one individual to the west. Looks like a female behind a dead tree, looking into the scene. She one of yours?"
"Michaels, Price," Andrea said over her personal radio system. "Wave to the chopper."
"Just waved at us," Trooper 3 reported at once.
"Okay, that's one of mine, covering the back."
"All right. We have no movement around the building, and no other people within 100 yards. We will continue to orbit and observe until you say otherwise."
"Thank you.
Out."
The Marine VH-60 landed on the athletic field. Sally and Little Jack were fairly thrown aboard, and Colonel Goodman lifted off at once, heading east toward the water, which, the Coast Guard had told him moments before, was free of unknown craft. He rocketed the Black Hawk to altitude, going north over the water. To his left, he could see the shape of a French-made police helicopter orbiting a few miles north of Annapolis. It didn't require much insight to explain it, and behind calm eyes, he wished for a couple of squads of recon Marines to deliver to the site. He'd once heard that criminals who hurt children faced a rough go in prison. But that wasn't half of what Marines would do if they got the chance. His reverie ended there. He didn't even look back to see how the other two kids were doing. He had an aircraft to fly.
That was his function. He had to trust others to do theirs. They were looking out the windows now. They were being careful about it. While the wounded one stood leaning against the wall, looked like a kneecap, O'Day saw, good.